Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Time for a pop quiz. Now, this is an easy one. It's just a repeat of the question you answered when you completed your census form last year. I mean, you did complete your census form, didn't you? Okay, here's the question. Choose the category that identifies your race. White, Black or African-American, American Indian and Alaska Native, Asian, or Native Hawaiian and other Pacific Islander. Or you can choose two or more races. Cool. Pencils down. All right. That was easy. Well, maybe. I mean, what box do you choose if your grandparents are from Algeria, Morocco, or Egypt? All those countries are part of the continent of Africa. Would that make you African-American? What if your parents recently immigrated from Syria or Lebanon? Should you mark Asian? This is the experience Arab Americans face with each government-required questionnaire, from the census to college admissions to job applications.
Now, on the United States Census form, if you check some other race and you put in an Arab country, do you know what happens to that form? Do you know what happens to that form? You know what they do with that form? They don't burn it. They don't give it to the FBI. They actually file it with white people. Did you know that? Yes. According to the federal government, we're white. Scary, right? For you, not for us.
That was comedian Amer Zaire finding some humor in the distance between how Arab Americans see themselves and how the federal government identifies and responds to the community. Shunting Arab Americans into the category of white Americans, but then treating them as not quite Americans. And it isn't a new problem. Back in the early 20th century, the Department of Justice heard a case on whether people from the Middle East could claim they were white in order to be allowed U.S. citizenship, or if they were Asian, which meant they could not. George Shashim, the Arab American on trial, told the court that he came from the same place as Jesus. So, of course, the ruling found that people from the Middle East were now white. Whoa. But advocates say that people from the Middle East have since become invisible in the U.S. as a result. And for decades, Arab American organizations have pushed the federal government to adjust official forms to stop what they say is an erasure of a community. But the question is, just who is a person of color? And are Arab Americans part of that group? For more, I spoke with historian and professor of American Studies and Ethnicity at the University of Southern California, Sarah Gualtieri, and Maya Berry, the executive director of the Arab American Institute. Maya started off by explaining the internal and external identifications of Arab Americans as people of color.
I actually talk about it exactly that way. I start by explaining that there is our identity, how we identify as individuals, and not even collectively, right? There's the sense of how each individual Arab American will identify, and then this externally imposed classification on us that comes from other sources. We're talking about a community of roughly 3.7 million Arab Americans in this country, and they identify with their national origin and ethnicity, and they don't fit in nicely into the racial classifications in terms of how people at least understand this. There are Black Arabs, there are white Arabs, there are brown Arabs. So it's a lot like the Latino community in terms of ethnicity and not necessarily a racial classification. And then we have this burden of being a community that's really often misunderstood for a variety of reasons that I trust we'd get into, but it does play into how this conversation plays out.
Yeah, Sarah, I think I just kind of want to ask you similarly this question of both internal self-identification and external identification of Arab Americans as people of color.
Yes, well, when I look at the, you know, over 150-year history of Arab American experience of race in the United States, I see so many instances of racial terror that I can't help but understand their experience as being that of a minoritized population. So very sadly, I could spend this entire segment enumerating cases of racial violence from the 1929 lynching of a Lebanese grocer in Florida to the 1985 assassination of Alex Ode, who was the West Coast Regional Director of the Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, or the 2015 murder of three Arab Muslim college students in Chapel Hill. So I understand this violence, like as a historian, I understand this violence to be fueled by ideas about their difference from a group of people understood to be white American. And I think that historically there has always been this tension whereby Arabs have been pulled out through external factors. They've been pulled out of this category of American. And I think that is where we find ourselves in a very fraught situation, and where you have longstanding communities in the United States who are quintessentially American, and yet there is a perception that they are always outsiders.
So this is interesting. And I'm wondering about the moments when that difference gets highlighted. Sarah, as a historian, maybe you can walk us through a few of the key historical moments, and then Maya, I'll come to you as well.
So what makes this conversation so interesting and nuanced, I think, is that there are moments in which Arab communities do access the privileges of whiteness, right? So if we're trying to understand this disconnect, you know, why is it that when you look at the census that Arabs are expected to classify themselves as white, and yet the lived experience of so many Arab Americans is clearly not as white citizens? Where does that disconnect come from? So in the early part of the 20th century, race was so connected to ideas of citizenship. There was, in fact, a racial requirement for citizenship. Briefly, the George Chisholm case is a really interesting case that unfolded here in Los Angeles in 1909. And one of the reasons I like to talk about this case is because there tends to be a perception that questions of race and racial identity as they relate to Arab Americans, particularly in this early part of the 20th century, that they unfolded particularly in the Jim Crow South. And the Chisholm case points to the fact that these debates were unfolding nationwide, right? So George Chisholm was a police officer in Venice, California. He arrested a young person and was at first unable to give testimony in court against him because it was deemed that George Chisholm was not a white person. And this drew on earlier legislation that basically said that people of color, or the language of the statute doesn't use that term, but Chinese, Black people, they could not give testimony in court against a white person. And so George Chisholm decides to get his naturalization, to get his citizenship, and to do so by conforming to the statute, which meant litigating his status as a white person.
Maya, I'm wondering if you can speak a bit to that, that sense of allyship, perhaps in the most recent moment, although 20 years now is perhaps not that recent, but I'm thinking the ways that again, the post 9/11 moment ends up conflating in American discourse, Arab American identity, Muslim identity, and then this kind of outsider status.
For me, the issue, it really does predate even the post 9/11 environment that we see. You know, I always start with Richard Nixon's Operation Boulder and the targeting of Arab students in this country who are engaged in advocacy for Palestinian human rights. It's been a defining issue in terms of the political exclusion that we've faced. And you know, the context of your question, right, is American identity white is part of what we're kind of talking about. Now, my answer is no, right? But the way that it's played out, particularly in a post 2016 presidential election, there's like this new way to understand Du Bois's new religion of whiteness, right? Like there's, and the way we fit into that is so interesting, partly for me based on this most recent election of the mayoral candidate in Boston, who is an Arab American woman who had to deal with a headline that said, "Boston mayoral candidate says she's a person of color. Is she?" So as a community, we are literally rendered invisible by government data. We have been fighting to get a new category on the census, a Middle East and North Africa category that would allow us to go in and collect more accurate information about Arab Americans for decades. We were there for 2020 until, regrettably, the Trump administration politicized the census in an unprecedented way. And then the category, movement on the category, was abandoned, though it was tested in 2015 and found to be a proper way, a more accurate way to gather data on this. So we're rendered invisible in that, and then highly visible and targeted by government policies that have securitized us as a community, that our fellow Americans sort of need to view us as differently. So for me, when I talk about these issues, it's like I have these four buckets I put it in. And I always start with the identity piece, because I think that's really important, which is how I choose to identify may be different than how Sarah does or how you do, Melissa. And that's the point of this conversation. We get to choose that. But there's a second piece of it, which is how we're classified by our government. And the issue of the census is just critical. It's done real and tangible harm to local communities when we don't have the appropriate data to be able to provide things like English as a second language program to appropriate political representation. But there's also the way we're seen by others, the way we're perceived by our other fellow Americans, right? And I gotta tell you, for the first time, we do a lot of polling on American attitudes. And for the first time ever that we got to the point of the majority of Americans not having a negative view of Arab Americans was in 2017, where we finally broke to 52%. And by the way, that's
when had that question first been asked?
We started doing polling on American attitudes in the late 90s, tracking it exactly the same way from 2010. But we've asked it differently dating back to the 90s. And I'll tell you, it broke at 52%. When we asked the question about Arabs, not Arab Americans, we didn't break 50. It was still at 42%. So this anti-Arab bigotry is real, and it's part of what we have to deal with. And then the final point I would make is, in terms of my buckets of understanding this, is that there's an element here in terms of how we're treated by state power, how we are profiled, how we're viewed in the context of counterterrorism policies, how we're talked about when it comes to immigration policies. And when we talk about, you know, working in coalition with partners, the profiling guidance that's in place right now continues to allow profiling on border security, national security, and local law enforcement.
I want to I'm going to come back to you, Sarah, to talk a little bit about sort of what you hinted at previously around acts of violence. You told us a few of them. Some of them are quite familiar to me, others not so much. I'm wondering if you could, and again, this is tough to do, but if you could help us to understand sort of, at least in the past maybe two or three decades, a reflection on state violence. And then we can talk a bit also about citizen-on-citizen violence.
I think in the case of Arab Americans, you so often seen this kind of this pairing of violence that is carried out against individual Arab Americans. So a woman is walking down the street in Chicago and her hijab is pulled off her head, or she's spat upon. Or so we might characterize that as a individualized violence carried out by one person upon another. But I think that what's important to hold on to here is that those acts of violence, those incidences of hate that are common, frequent, carried out in multiple locations, that they are fueled by these policies, by policies of exclusion, particularly at the federal level, the Muslim ban, for example, that feeds into a kind of American imaginary of in which Arab Americans are thought of, as I've mentioned before, as other, as perpetually foreign, right? So I think that it's hard to disentangle the issue of sort of individual violence or hate incidences carried out on the bodies of Arab Americans from larger policies, including policies that are international, right? So this question of how do we understand the racialized experience of Arab Americans, in my view, has to be understood with a transnational lens. I mean, we have Arab Americans in this country for many reasons, but one of them is because so many of their families have been rendered refugees by American state policy, and most especially the carrying out of wars against Arab populations.
Maya, I wanted to come back to you on the issues that you'd begun to lay out for us around the census. Can you say a bit more about the campaign to include new categories and what that could mean for Arab American communities?
Oh, absolutely. It'd be transformative. When I say rendered invisible in the data, it is because there has been a massive undercount of our community historically. And so anywhere from medical research, we believe there's a higher prevalence of diabetes in our community. And we have medical researchers who tell us, I don't know what the denominator is. I can't conduct accurate research on our community because I don't know, you know, how to get that number. And I have to actually just mention this additional point because Sarah was talking about hate crimes. And we do a great deal of work on hate crimes. Arab Americans were part of the reason, when you look at the Hate Crime Statistics Act that was passed back in 1990, we're actually part of the reason for the passage of that act. There were congressional hearings looking at a then FBI director deemed Arab Americans as being in what he called a zone of danger. We were literally targeted with extreme violence. And Sarah mentioned the murder of civil rights advocate Alex Oda was part of that. And at the time, we had something called Code 31, which was a category for anti-Arab hate, and it existed in the other categories. We lost that category for reasons that are not clear to us. As hate crime data progressed from 1990 until 2015, there was no anti-Arab hate category that could be tracked. So when you ask me the question about our polling and how far it went back to, I can only cite you hate crime data on Arab Americans starting in 2015. So we go back to when it's time to, in a post 9/11 environment, institute a program like NSEERS and target people from Arab countries and deport countless numbers of Arab men back to the Arab world, we can find them. When it comes time to identifying victims of hate crimes, when it comes time to allocating trillions of dollars of government resources tied to census data, we can't find us.
That was Executive Director of the Arab American Institute, Maya Berry, and Historian and Professor of American Studies and Ethnicity at USC, Sarah Gualtieri. Maya, Sarah, thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa. It's been a pleasure to be with you today. And also, thank you, Maya.
I'm so grateful for the conversation. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, Melissa. And I think that for a community that's often ignored, the importance of talking about this with your viewers is really appreciated. Thank you so much.